WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Sedge Thompson. My guest today is journalist and biographer Ted Morgan. His new book is An Uncertain Hour: The French, the Germans, the Jews, the Klaus Barbie Trial, and the City of Lyon. The story of Klaus Barbie is a personal story for Morgan, as well as a compelling illumination of history. Morgan was born Sanche de Gramont in France in the 1930s. His family fled the Nazis during the war and came to the United States. In 1977, he became an American citizen and changed his name to an anagram of de Gramont, Ted Morgan. He's written about that experience in the autobiographical book On Becoming American. Morgan has also written several biographies, including books on William Burroughs, Somerset Maugham, and Franklin Roosevelt. An Uncertain Hour details information uncovered during the trial of war criminal Klaus Barbie in Lyon. Morgan obtained a copy of the 10,000 pages of secret documents prepared for the trial, which reveal new information about resistance and collaboration in France during the Nazi occupation. Morgan went to Lyon to cover the trial for the New York Times Magazine. I asked Ted Morgan what compelled him to be a reporter there.
You see, I'm originally French, and I grew up in Paris, and my father, at the beginning of the war in 1940, went to London and joined General de Gaulle and became a bomber pilot, and flew a certain number of missions over Germany, and then was killed in an accident in 1943. And that's something that's always sort of stayed with me, and so I wanted to, the trial for me was an opportunity to go back and sort of investigate and find out more about that period, because in 1940 we saw the Germans come in. After my father left, my mother and my brothers and myself stayed in France in the unoccupied zone, and the Germans came in, and then they left again once the country was divided into the two zones, and we got out through Spain and Portugal and came back to this country. So I felt that I'd sort of missed out on the occupation years.
What was your feeling about going back to France and covering something that had been clearly a very intensely personal issue in time for the French people?
Well, my feeling was to find out more about it. And as Lincoln said on the eve of the Battle of Gettysburg, we cannot escape history. And so you're stuck with this, you know, because of what happened to my father, and you're just stuck with this period that you can't get out of, which is, to me, the occupation. And it was just a chance to discover, to get more detail on it, to see through the prism of this trial and all the... There were hundreds of witnesses. They all came and told their stories. It was fascinating. It was like theater to me. And then the war criminal himself, to try to fathom what he was like, and it was a great experience, I thought.
The war trial of Klaus Barbie seemed to bring up issues in France like scratching an old scab. It brought up issues of collaboration and of resistance. It seemed actually to be a time where France tried to sort of re-examine and scratch itself again.
Yeah, there was a lot of that, and because the French were, I think, after the war, heavily into denial, and de Gaulle came and he sort of justified he had done the right thing. He had resisted. He had opposed the Germans. But when you're on the spot and in a city like Lyon, the people who were there. I mean, it divides into many subcategories, you know. For instance, the great majority just went on with their lives as usual. And then you have those who were actively resisting, you have those who were actively collaborating, you have the businessmen who are doing business with the Germans. You have, for instance, in France during the occupation, there was a very thriving film industry. All those movies were made with German permission and sometimes with German co-producers and with German money. And they were, some of them are very great movies, like Les Enfants du Paradis was made during the occupation with German approval.
Can you describe a bit of the atmosphere of the courtroom of Lyon?
Yeah, well, it was very crowded, and it was not held in a regular courtroom. They took the huge entrance room of the tribunal and turned it into a courtroom, and they had three judges, and in these red robes with ermine fringes. And then they had a glass booth for Barbie, and he would come in and step into this glass booth. And then you had the prosecutor, and then you had about 25 lawyers who were representing victims of Barbie, and they were allowed to be there, not exactly as co-prosecutors, but they asked questions, and they each represented one of the victims who came and acted as a witness in the trial. So you had a lot of lawyers all in their black robes, and then you had a big, big press gallery. And it started, I believe, it would start around 1 in the afternoon and then go on until about 6. And then you had the problem that Barbie didn't want to testify because he said that he'd been kidnapped out of Bolivia, where he'd escaped after the war. And so for most of the time, he wasn't even there. And that was very anticlimactical because you expect him to be confronted, because the people that he arrested and tortured in Lyon were sent to the camps, and they came back, and they were able to testify against him. And there were a couple of confrontations like that that were extremely emotional, because the people who had come back from the camps, when confronted with him, they completely lost their composure, and one of them. You know, tried to go for him toward the booth and had to be restrained. And another one one woman, you know, practically fainted. And there were some very dramatic moments, but it was a very long trial. It lasted for over 2 months. And most of the time, as I say, Barbie wasn't even there. And then, of course, at the end, and then, of course, there was a jury. There's a jury of 9 in France, plus the 3 judges sit with the jury. And it's not like the American system. The judges and the jury deliberate together. And so they deliberated for a few hours, and I think when they brought the verdict in, it was around midnight, and we were all sitting there waiting. And they came in and they gave the verdict, and then they brought Barbie in for the last time to hear the verdict, and the judge asked him, "Do you have anything to say?" And he said, "I did some hard things, but it was the war, and now the war is over." That's what he said. And I remember thinking at the time, it's never over, and that's why he's here, you know.
My guest is Ted Morgan. His new book is An Uncertain Hour. One of the astonishing aspects of this time of French history, 1940 to 45, was the degree of collaboration that went on, and in fact was brought up as a topic many times, both in the press and during the trial. What astonished you most about the collaboration in France?
Well, there again, it's the variety of the collaboration. You have people who, for instance, went into the Charlemagne SS division. This was a German SS division made up of French volunteers, and some of them were interviewed afterward, and one of them said that it wasn't that he liked the Germans, but he would rather be fighting the Russians on the Eastern Front than be involved with the Vichy government. So out of a distaste for Vichy, he joins the SS. It's really bizarre. And then you had the guy who was running a newspaper, in Paris, and so he had to run the paper the way the Germans wanted it. So he went along and he became a collaborator because he wanted to continue running his paper. And he had journalists who wanted to continue getting their bylines, and so they, you know, were turning out this collaborationist paper. So you had many, many kinds of collaboration. You had some ideological collaboration that were anti-Semites and pro-Nazi, and they collaborated out of conviction. And then you had the ones that did it to get a job promotion or something like that. I mean, there were many kinds of collaboration.
The sense of this time of the occupation was that anti-Semitic French could use it as an excuse to cover up their anti-Semitic activities.
Not only an excuse, but they were actively encouraged to act out their anti-Semitic feelings, and that was one of the worst things about Vichy, that it had a state. There was a state policy of anti-Semitism, and Vichy at first went along with the Germans on their deportation program, and one of the things that not shocked exactly, but that surprised me, was the extent of the police, of the French police involvement in the deportations, because the Germans didn't want to use their own army, their own soldiers, to deport Jews. And the Vichy made a deal with the Germans that if the Germans deported foreign Jews instead of French Jews, they would help the Germans do it. And their rationale was, we're protecting our own French Jews, because there were a great many foreign Jews in France. And so Vichy used its own police to round up the foreign Jews, to take them to certain detention camps in France, and then to take them from the detention camps to the trains. And there were literally tens of thousands of foreign Jews who were sent to the camps this way, and I could not find one single example of one single French policeman who ever said, I will not do this. And although there were cases when the French police would give advance notice to certain Jews, but this is particularly in Paris that this happened, and tip them off and say, you'd better not be at home tomorrow or something like that. Or in one case, there was a little a mother with her two daughters, and the police came, and the mother said, "Oh, I can't let my daughter go until I've combed her hair, and I can't find the comb." And one of the policemen said to the girl, "Why don't you go down to the store downstairs and get a comb?" And he was giving her a chance to escape, and she went down there, and then she came back because she didn't know where to go. Mm-hmm. And so there were stories like that.
How hard was it for you as a writer and a researcher to hear these stories and to come across them? I would think that some of them would be enough to make you weep.
It's not it was on a daily basis, and there was story after story after story, and it's discouraging to listen to that, you know. And of course, on the other hand, you did have the witnesses who survived and who came back to tell the story. And I thought it was quite wonderful that after all these years they were still around and could describe what they'd been through. And again, in this Lyon thing with Barbie, when he raided the Jewish welfare office in the heart of Lyon, and some of the people there were able to get away. And there was one woman there, and she came in, because it was the day where people came in for medical. There was the doctor on duty that day, so there were a lot of people there, and then the Gestapo came in and raided it. and stayed there. And so everybody, every time somebody else came in, the door was opened by a Gestapo man who said, "Come on in," you know. And then they were stuck, and they were arrested. And so this one woman had some sheet music. She'd just come from her piano lesson. And one of the Gestapo men picks up the sheet music, and he could read music, and he sees that it's a Beethoven piano thing, and he starts humming it, you know, and then he gives it back to her and says, "You can leave." And so she was able to get out of it because she had some German sheet music on her. And so it's just endlessly, you know, an endless variety of human behavior in these stories.
Although you've given up your French citizenship, you're still very moved by memories of your youth, patriotic memories, including a troop of soldiers, mostly veterans of World War I, called the Broken Faces. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could talk about who these people were and when you remember seeing them.
Well, in World War I, in the trench warfare, the shrapnel, they had these shells that exploded in the air before they hit the ground, and the shrapnel would fly all over the place. And as a result, there were a great many face wounds. And this was quite common, and they had a special ward in the Val de Grâce hospital in Paris for these so-called broken faces called gueule cassée. So when I was a boy in Paris, my father took me to this 14th of July, the great 14 juillet parade, and I was sitting on his shoulders, and he said, "Here come the gueule cassée," and because they marched a detachment of them every 14 juillet in the parade, and one of them's carrying a flag, and they're all marching, you know, high-stepping and everything. And as they get closer, I see that, you know, one of them has a leather patch where his nose should be. Another one has a face that looks like oatmeal, you know. I mean, it was just a ghastly sight. And that sort of gives you a kind of historical continuity to the whole story, because these guys were mangled in World War I. Then 20 years later, it starts all over again in 1940. And then there's another generation that goes out.
You describe the gueule cassée, the broken faces in the Bastille Day parade, as representing a time of unjudging and unconditional patriotism, but that you didn't think that after World War II there were any more in the parade. What changed in France between World War I and World War II that went from this time of great intense patriotism to one of willing collaboration?
Uh-huh. What changed, I think, was that the next war came too quickly, and people are exhausted, and you can't ask people to go through something like that again. And so the whole mentality at the beginning of World War II was completely different. There was no enthusiasm. There was no will to win. There was a completely defensive mentality, which is illustrated by the Maginot Line, you know, which is really saying, "We're not going to attack you if you don't attack us."
Were you astonished by the role that Americans played after World War II in making it possible for German war criminals to escape? You adopted America as your new country, mm-hmm. and did this surprise you, or did it seem sort of natural given the climate of the times?
It seemed, in an odd way, it seemed natural, because when the American military intelligence recruited Barbie in 1947, the Cold War had begun. Germany had been carved up into four occupation zones. Germany was no longer dangerous. They had caught most of the major war criminals. They had had the Nuremberg trial and convicted them, and the ones who had escaped weren't talked about that much. And so they had recruited Galen, and who came with all his files to the military intelligence to hand over everything he knew, and they wanted to find professional intelligence people to do their espionage on the Russians. The Cold War was on. And so, in a way, it was logical for them to hire someone like Barbie, even though he was morally reprehensible. And I talked to all his CIC handlers, as they were called. They're still around. They're very, very nice men. And they said, well, you know, that was our job. We were supposed to collect intelligence. I said, well, didn't you feel that this man was a swine? I said, no, we worked with him, and we didn't know that much about him, really. It hadn't come out yet. And so in the logic of the times, they were simply hiring professional intelligence people who knew their jobs to spy on the Russians and to spy on on German communists, which was one of their targets, to infiltrate the German Communist Party and the German labor movement, and Barbie was pretty good at that.
An Uncertain Hour seems to be then a chronicle of pragmatic behavior.
I'm afraid that's true, that most people do act pragmatically. Now, the people who don't act pragmatically are the ideologues, and on the ideologues on both sides. That is, the people who believe ahead of their own interests in their country, like the resistance heroes, like Jean Moulin, for instance, and the collaborators are also ideologues who are the worst abettors of the Nazis, did the occupiers dirty work for them.
Well, Ted Morgan, thank you very much for coming in and being a guest with us on Fresh Air today.
Well, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Ted Morgan's new book is An Uncertain Hour: The French, the Germans, the Jews, the Klaus Barbie Trial, and the City of Lyon. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.